to the surface, I was all right, and both Marcus and the instructors cleared me. Though we ended up in different teams, Marcus and I kept in touch as the years went by. It seemed like every time I was coming back from a combat deployment, he was coming in to relieve me. We'd have lunch together and trade informal intel back and forth. Toward the end of SQT, we got orders telling us which SEAL team we were about to join. Even though we had graduated buds, we didn't consider ourselves real SEALs yet. It was only when we joined a team that we would get our tridents, and even then we'd have to prove ourselves first. The SEAL tridents, also known as a Budweiser, is a metal device or badge worn by SEALs. Besides Neptune's trident, the symbol includes an eagle and an anchor. At the time, there were 6 teams, meaning 3 choices on each coast, east and west. My top pick was SEAL Team 3, which was based out of Coronado, California. I chose it because that team had seen action in the Middle East and was likely to return. I wanted to get into the heat if I could. I think all of us did. My next 2 choices were for teams based on the East Coast, because I'd been in Virginia, where they are headquartered. I'm not a big fan of Virginia, but I liked it a lot better than California. San Diego, the city near Coronado, has beautiful weather, but Southern California is the land of nuts. I wanted to live somewhere with a little more sanity. I'd been told by the detailer I worked for that he would make sure I got my top choice. I wasn't 100% sure that was going to happen, but at that point, I would have accepted whatever assignment I got, obviously, since I had no real say in the matter. Getting the actual assignment was the opposite of dramatic. They brought us into a big classroom and handed out paper with our orders. I got my top choice, Team 3. Love. Something else happened to me that spring that had an enormous impact not just on my military career, but on my life. I fell in love. I don't know if you believe in love at first sight. I don't think I did before the night in April of 2001 when I saw Taya standing at a bar in a San Diego club talking with one of my friends. She had a way of making black leather pants look smoking hot and classy. The combination suited me fine. I just joined Team 3. We hadn't started training yet, and I was enjoying what amounted to a week of vacation before getting down to the serious business of becoming a SEAL and earning my place on a team. Taya was working for a pharmaceutical company as a drug rep when we met. Originally from Oregon, she'd gone to college in Wisconsin and moved out to the coast a couple years before we met. My first impression was that she was beautiful, even if she looked pissed off about something. When we started talking, I also found out she was smart and had a good sense of humor. I sensed right away she was someone who could keep up with me. But maybe she should tell the story. Her version sounds better than mine. Taya. I remember the night we met. Some of it, at least. I wasn't going to go out. This was all during a low spot in my life. My days were spent in a job I didn't like. I was fairly new in town and still looking for some solid female friendships. And I was casually dating guys, with not much success. Over the years, I'd had some decent relationships and a couple of bad ones, with a few dates in between. I remember literally praying to God before I met Chris to just send me a nice guy. Nothing else mattered, I thought. I just prayed for someone who was inherently good and nice. A girlfriend called and wanted to go down to San Diego. I was living in Long Island Beach at the time, about 90 miles away. I wasn't going to go, but somehow she talked me into it. We were walking around that night, and we passed a bar named Maloney's. They were blaring Land Down Under by Men at Work. My friend wanted to go in, but they had an outrageous cover charge, something like 10 or 15 bucks. I'm not doing that, I told her. Not for a bar that's playing Men at Work. Oh, shut up, my girlfriend said. She paid the cover and we went in. We were at the bar. I was drinking and irritable. This tall, good-looking guy came over and started talking to me. I'd been talking to one of his friends, who seemed like a jerk. My mood was still pretty bad, though. He had a certain air about him. He told me his name, Chris. And I told him mine. What do you do? I asked.
I drive an ice cream truck.
You're full of shit, I told him. Obviously, you're military.
No, no, he protested.
He told me a bunch of other things. SEALs almost never admit to strangers what they'd really do, and Chris had some of the best BS stories ever. One of the better ones was Dolphin Waxer. He claimed that dolphins in captivity needed to be waxed so their skin didn't disintegrate. It's a pretty convincing story, if you're a young, naive, and tipsy girl. Fortunately, he didn't try that particular one on me. I hope because he could tell I wouldn't fall for it. He's also convinced girls that he mans an ATM machine, sitting inside and doling out money when people put their cards in. I wasn't really near that naive or drunk for him to try that story. One look at him and I could have told he was military. He was ripped and had short hair and had an accent that said, "Not from here." Finally, he admitted he was in the service. "So what do you do in the military?" I asked. He said a bunch of other things and I finally got the truth. I just graduated from BUDS. I was like, "Okay, so you're a SEAL." "Yeah." "I know all about you guys," I told him. "You see, my sister had just divorced her husband. My brother-in-law had wanted to be a SEAL. He'd gone through some of the training, and so I knew, or thought I did, what SEALs were all about. So I told Chris." "You're arrogant, self-centered, and glory-seeking," I said. "You lie and think you can do whatever you want." Yes, I was at my charming best. What was intriguing was how he responded. He didn't smirk or get clever or even act offended. He seemed truly puzzled. "Why would you say that?" he asked, very innocently and genuine. I told him about my brother-in-law. "I would lay down my life for my country," he answered. "How is that self-centered? That's the opposite." He was so idealistic and romantic about things like patriotism and serving the country that I couldn't help but believe him. We talked for a while more, then my friend came over and I turned my attention to her. Chris said something like he was going to go home. "Why?" I asked. "Well, you were saying about how you never would date a SEAL or go out with one." "Oh, no. I said I would never marry one. I didn't say I wouldn't go out with one." His face lit up. "In that case," he said, with that sly little smile he has, "I guess I'll get your phone number." He hung around. I hung around. We were still there at last call. As I got up with the crowd to go, I was pushed against him. He was all hard and muscly and smelled good, so I gave him a little kiss on his neck. We went out and he walked us to the parking lot, and I started puking my brains out from all the scotch on the rocks I'd been drinking. How can you not love a girl who loses it the first time you meet? I knew from the start that this was someone I wanted to spend a lot of time with. But at first, it was impossible to do that. I called her the morning after we met to make sure she was okay. We talked and laughed a bit. After that, I'd call her and leave messages. She didn't call back. The other guys on the team started ribbing me about it. They were betting about whether she'd ever call me on her own. You see, we talked a few times when she would actually answer the phone, maybe thinking it was someone else. After a while, it was obvious to me that she never initiated. Then something changed. I remember the first time she called me. We were on the East Coast, training. When we were done talking, I ran inside and started jumping on my teammates' beds. I took the call as a sign she was really interested. I was happy to share that fact with all the naysayers. Taya. Chris was always aware of my feelings. He is extremely observant in general, and it is the same with his awareness of my emotions. He doesn't have to say much. A simple question, or easy way of bringing something to light, reveals that he is 100% aware of my feelings. He doesn't necessarily enjoy talking about feelings, but he has a sense of when it is appropriate or necessary to bring things out that I may have been intent on keeping in. I noticed it early on in our relationship. We would be talking on the phone, and he was very caring. We are in many ways opposites. Still, we seemed to click. One day on the phone, he was asking what I thought made us compatible. I decided to tell him some of the things that drew me to him. "I think you're a really good guy," I told him, "really nice and sensitive." "Sensitive?" He was shocked and sounded offended. "What do you mean?" "You don't know what sensitive means?"
"You mean like I go around crying at movies and stuff?"
I laughed. I explained that I meant that he seemed to pick up on how I was feeling, sometimes before I did. And he let me express that emotion, and importantly, gave me space. I don't think that's the image most people have of SEALs, but it was and is accurate, at least of this one. September 11, 2001. As our relationship got closer and closer, Tay and I started spending more time with each other. Finally, we'd spend nights at each other's apartment, either in Long Beach or San Diego. I woke up one morning to her yelling, Chris, wake up. You've got to see this. I stumbled into the living room. Tay had turned on the television and jacked the volume. I saw smoke pouring out of the World Trade Center in New York. I didn't understand what all was happening. Part of me was still sleeping. Then, as we watched, an airplane flew right into the side of the second tower.
Motherfuckers, I muttered.
I stared at the screen, angry and confused, not entirely sure it was real. Suddenly, I remembered that I left my cell phone off. I grabbed it and saw I'd missed a bunch of messages. The sum total of them was this. Kyle, get your ass back to base, now. I grabbed Taya's SUV, it had plenty of gas and my truck didn't, and hauled down to base. I don't know exactly how fast I was going, it might have been three digits, but it was certainly a high rate of speed. Down around San Juan Capistrano, I glanced in the rearview mirror and saw a set of red lights flashing. I pulled over. The cop who came up to the truck was pissed.
Is there any reason you're going so fast? He demanded.
Yes, sir, I told him. I apologize. I'm in the military and I just got recalled. I understand you got to write me a ticket. I know I was in the wrong, but with all due respect, can you just hurry and give me the ticket so I can get back to base?
What branch are you in?
Motherfucker, I thought. I just told you I have to report. Can't you just give me the damn ticket? But I kept my cool. I'm in the Navy, I told him.
What are you doing in the Navy? He asked.
By now, I was pretty annoyed. I'm a SEAL. He closed his ticket book.
I'll take you to the city line, he told me. Go get some fucking payback.
He put his lights on and pulled in front of me. We went a bit slower than I'd been going when he nabbed me, but it was still well past the limit. He took me as far as his jurisdiction went, maybe a little farther, then waved me on. Training. We were put on immediate standby, but it would turn out that we weren't needed in Afghanistan or anywhere else at that moment. My platoon would have to wait roughly a year before we got into action, and when we did, it would be against Saddam Hussein, not Osama bin Laden. There's a lot of confusion in the civilian world about SEALs and our mission. Most people think we're strictly sea-based commandos, meaning that we always operate off ships and hit targets on the water or on the immediate coastline. Admittedly, a fair amount of our work involves things at sea. We're in the Navy, after all. And from a historical perspective, as briefly mentioned earlier, SEALs trace their origins to the Navy's underwater demolition teams, or UDTs. Established during World War II, UDT frogmen were responsible for reconning beaches before they were hit, and they trained for a variety of other waterborne tasks, such as infiltrating harbors and planting limpet mines on enemy ships. They were the mean, badass combat divers of World War II and the post-war era, and SEALs are proud to carry on in their wake. But as the UDT mission expanded, the Navy recognized that the need for special operations didn't end at the beach line. As new units called SEALs were formed and trained for this expanded mission, they came to replace the older UDT units. While land may be the final word in the SEAL acronym, it's hardly the last thing we do. Every special operations unit in the U.S. military has its own specialty. There's a lot of overlap in our training, and the range of our missions is similar in many respects, but each branch has its own expertise. Army Special Forces, also known as SF, does an excellent job training foreign forces, both in conventional and unconventional warfare. Army Rangers are a big assault force, and if you want a large target, say an airfield taken down, that's their thing. Air Force Special Operators, Parajumpers, excel at pulling people out of the shit. Among our specialties are DAs. DA stands for Direct Action. A direct action mission is a very short, quick strike against a small but high-value target. You might think of it as a surgical strike against the enemy. In a practical sense, it could range from anything like an attack on a key bridge behind enemy lines to a raid on a terrorist hideout to arrest a bomb maker, a snatch and grab, as some call it. While those are very different missions, the idea is the same. Strike hard and fast before the enemy knows what's going on. After 9/11, SEALs began training to deal with the places Islamic terrorists were most likely to be located, Afghanistan, number one, and then the Middle East and Africa. We still did all the things a SEAL is supposed to do, diving, jumping out of planes, taking down ships, etc. But there was more emphasis on land warfare during our workup than there traditionally had been in the past. There was a debate about this shift far above my pay grade. Some people wanted to limit SEALs to 10 miles inland. Nobody asked my opinion, but as far as I'm concerned, there shouldn't be any limits. Personally, I'm just as happy to stay out of the water, but that's beside the point. Let me do what I'm trained to do wherever it needs to be done. The training, most of it anyway, was fun, even when it was a kick in the balls. We dove, we went into the desert, we worked in the mountains. We even got waterboarded and gassed. Everybody gets waterboarded during training. The idea is to prepare you in case you're captured. The instructors tortured us as hard as they could, tying us up and pounding on us, just short of permanently damaging us. They say each of us has a breaking point, and that prisoners eventually give in. But I would have done my best to make them kill me before I gave up secrets. Gas training was another kick. Basically, you get hit with CS gas and have to fight through it. CS gas is captor spray, or tear gas. The active ingredient is 2-chlorobenzylmalonynitrile for all of you chemistry majors. We thought of it as cough and spit because that's the best way to deal with it. You learn during training to let your eyes run. The worst thing to do is rub them. You're going to get snotty, and you're going to be coughing and crying, but you can still shoot your weapon and fight through it. That's the point of the exercise. We went up to Kodiak, Alaska, where we did a land navigation course. It wasn't the height of winter, but there was still so much snow on the ground that we had to put on snowshoes. We started with basic instruction on keeping warm, layering up, etc., and learned about things like snow shelters. One of the important points of this training, which applied everywhere, was learning how to conserve weight in the field. You have to figure out whether it's more important to be lighter and more mobile, or to have more ammunition and body armor. I prefer lightness and speed. I count ounces when we go out, not pounds. The lighter you are, the more mobile you become. The little bastards out there are faster than hell. You need every advantage you can get on them. The training was pretty competitive. We found out at one point that the best platoon in the team would be shipped out to Afghanistan. Training picked up from that point on. It was a fierce competition, and not just out on the training range. The officers were backstabbing each other. They'd go to the CO and dime each other out. "Did you see what those guys did on the range? They're no good." The competition came down to us and one other platoon. We came in second. They went to war. We stayed home. That's about the worst fate a SEAL can imagine. With the conflict in Iraq looming on the horizon, our emphasis shifted. We practiced fighting in the desert. We practiced fighting in cities. We worked hard, but there were always lighter moments. I remember one time we were on a rut, real urban training. Our command would find a municipality that was willing to have us come in and take down an actual building, an empty warehouse, say, or a house, something a little more authentic than you would find on a base. On this one exercise, we were working at a house. Everything had been carefully arranged with the local police department. A few actors had been recruited to play parts during the exercise. My role was to pull security outside. I blocked out traffic, waving vehicles away as some of the local cops watched from the sidelines. While I was standing there, gun out, not looking particularly friendly, this guy walked down the block toward me. I started going through the drill. First, I waved him off. He kept coming. Then I shined my light on him. He kept coming. I put my laser dot on him. He kept coming. Of course, the closer he got, the more convinced I was that he was a role player sent to test me. I mentally reviewed my ROEs, rules of engagement, which covered how I was supposed to act. "What are you, the Po-Po?" he asked, sticking his face out toward mine. Po-Po, a thug's term for police, wasn't in the ROEs, but I figured he was ad-libbing. The next thing on my list was to throw him down, so I did. He started to resist, and reached under his jacket for what I assumed was a weapon, which is exactly what a SEAL playing a bad guy would do. So I reacted in kind, giving a good SEAL response as I wrestled him into the dirt and busted him up a bit. Whatever was under his jacket broke, and liquid went everywhere. He was cussing and carrying on, but I didn't take the time to think about all that just then. As the fight ran out of him, I cuffed him and looked around. The cops, seated in their patrol car nearby, were just about doubled over laughing. I went over to see what was up. "That's so-and-so," they told me, "one of the biggest drug dealers in the city. We wish we could have beat him just like you did." Apparently, Mr. Popo ignored all the signs and wandered into the training exercise, figuring he'd carry on business as usual. There are idiots everywhere. But I guess that explains how he got into that line of work in the first place. Hazed and hitched. For months, the United Nations Security Council pressured Iraq to comply fully with UN resolutions, especially those requiring inspections of suspected weapons of mass destruction and related sites. War wasn't a foregone conclusion. Saddam Hussein could have complied and shown inspectors everything they wanted to see, but most of us knew he wouldn't. So when we got the word that we were shipping out to Kuwait, we were excited. We figured we were going to war. One way or the other, there was plenty to do out there. Besides watching Iraq's borders and protecting the Kurdish minority, who Saddam had gassed and massacred in the past, U.S. troops were enforcing no-fly zones in the north and south. Saddam was smuggling oil and other items both into and out of his country in violation of the U.N. sanctions. The U.S. and other allies were stepping up operations to stop that. Before we deployed, Taya and I chose to get married. The decision surprised both of us. One day we were talking in the car, and we both came to the conclusion that we should get married. The decision stunned me, even as I made it. I agreed with it. It was completely logical. We were definitely in love. I knew she was the woman I wanted to spend my life with, and yet, for some reason, I didn't think the marriage would last. We both knew that there is an extremely high divorce rate in the SEALs. As a matter of fact, I've heard marriage counselors claim that it is close to 95%, and I believe it. So maybe that was what worried me. Perhaps part of me wasn't really ready to think about a lifetime commitment. And of course, I understood how demanding my job was going to be once we went to war. I can't explain the contradictions. But I do know that I was absolutely in love, and that she loved me. And so, for better or worse, make that peace or war, marriage was our next step together. Happily, we survived it all. One thing you ought to know about SEALs. When you're new to the teams, you get hazed. The platoons are very tight-knit groups. Newcomers, always called new guys, are treated like hell until they prove they belong. That usually doesn't happen until well into their first deployment, if then. New guys get the shit jobs. They're constantly tested. They're always beat on. It's a kind of an extended hazing that takes many forms. For example, on a training exercise, you work hard. The instructors kick your ass all day long. Then, when you're done, the platoon will go out and party. When we're out on a training mission, we usually drive around in large 12-passenger vans. A new guy always drives, which, of course, means he can't drink when we hit the bars, at least not to SEAL standards. That's the mildest form of hazing. In fact, it's so mild it's not really hazing. Choking him out while he's driving, that's hazing. One night soon after I joined my platoon, we were out partying after a training mission. When we left the bar, all the older guys piled into the back. I wasn't driving, but I had no problem with that. I like to sit up front. We were speeding along for a while, and all of a sudden I heard, 1, 2, 3, 4, I declare a van war. The next thing I knew, I was pummeled. Van war meant it was open season on the new guys. I came out of that one with bruised ribs and a black eye, maybe two. I must have gotten my lip busted a dozen times during hazing. I should say that van wars are separate from bar fights, another SEAL staple. SEALs are pretty notorious for getting into bar scrapes, and I was no exception. I've been arrested more than once through the years, though As a general rule, the charges were either never filed or quickly dismissed.
Why do seals fight so much?
I haven't made a scientific study of it, but I think a lot is owed to pent-up aggression. We're trained to go out and kill people, and then at the same time we're also being taught to think of ourselves as invincible badasses. That's a pretty potent combination. When you go into a bar, you'll always have someone who will poke a shoulder into you or otherwise imply you should fuck off. Happens in every bar across the world. Most people just ignore things like that. If someone does that to a SEAL, we're going to turn and knock you out. But at the same time, I have to say that while SEALs end a lot of fights, we usually don't start many. In a lot of cases, the fights are the result of some sort of stupid jealousy or the need for a dumbass to test his own manhood and earn bragging rights for fighting a SEAL. When we go into bars, we don't just cower down in the corner or lay low. We go in extremely confident. Maybe we're loud. And with us being mostly young and in great shape, people take notice. Girls gravitate toward a group of SEALs, and maybe that makes their boyfriends jealous. Or guys want to prove something for some other reason. Either way, things escalate, and fights happen. But I wasn't talking about bar fights. I was talking about hazing and my wedding. We were in the Nevada mountains. It was cold, so cold that it was snowing. I had gotten a few days' leave to get married. I was due to take off in the morning. The rest of the platoon still had some work to do. We got back that night to our temporary base and went inside to the mission planning room. The chief told everybody that we'd relax and have a few beers while we mapped out the next day's operation. Then he turned to me. "Hey, new guy," he told me. "Go grab the beer and the booze out of the van and bring it in here." I hopped, too. When I came back in, everyone was sitting in chairs. There was only one left, and it was kind of in the middle of a circle of others. I didn't think too much about it as I sat down. "All right, this is what we're going to do," my chief said, standing in front of a dry erase board at the front of the room. "The operation will be an ambush. The target will be in the center. We will completely encircle it." That doesn't sound too smart, I thought. If we come in from every direction, we'll be shooting each other. Usually our ambushes are planned in an L shape to avoid that. I looked at the chief. The chief looked at me. Suddenly, his serious expression gave way to a shit-ass grin. With that, the rest of the platoon bum-rushed me. I hit the floor a second later. They cuffed me to a chair and then began my kangaroo court. There were a lot of charges against me. The first was the fact that I had let it be known that I wanted to become a sniper. "The new guy is ungrateful," thundered the prosecutor. "He does not want to do his job. He thinks he is better than the rest of us." I tried to protest, but the judge, none other than the chief himself, quickly ruled me out of order. I turned to my defense attorney. "What do you expect?" he said. "He's only got a third-grade education." "Guilty," declared the judge. "Next charge." "Your Honor, the defendant is disrespectful," said the prosecutor. "He told the CO to fuck off." "Objection," said my lawyer. "He told the OIC to fuck off." The CO is the commanding officer of the team. The OIC is the officer in charge of the platoon. A pretty big difference, except in this case. "Guilty. Next charge." For every offense I was found guilty of, which meant anything and everything they could make up, I had to take a drink of Jack Daniels and Coke, followed by a shooter of Jack. They got me pretty wasted before we even got to the felonies. At some point, they stripped me down and put ice down my drawers. Finally, I passed out. Then they spray-painted me and, for good measure, drew Playboy bunnies on my chest and back with a marker, just the sort of body art you want for your honeymoon. At some point, my friends apparently became concerned about my health. So they taped me to a spine board completely naked, took me outside, and stood me up in the snow. They left me for a while until I regained some amount of consciousness. By then I was jackhammering hard enough to put a hole through a bunker roof. They gave me an IV, the saline helps cut down the alcohol in your system, and finally took me back to the hotel, still taped to the spine board. All I remember from the rest of the night is being lifted up a bunch of stairs, apparently to my motel room. There must have been a few spectators because the boys were yelling, "Nothing to see here, nothing to see," as they carried me in. Taya washed off most of the paint and the bunnies when I met up with her the next day, but a few were still visible under my shirt. I kept my jacket tightly buttoned for the ceremony. By then, the swelling in my face was almost completely gone. The stitches in my eyebrow, from a friendly fight among teammates a few weeks earlier, were healing nicely. The cut on my lip, from a training exercise, was also healing pretty well. It's probably not every bride's dream to have a spray-painted beat-up groom, but Taya seemed happy enough. The amount of time we had for our honeymoon, though, was a sore point. The team was gracious enough to give me 3 days to get hitched and honeymoon. As a new guy, I was appreciative of the brief leave. My new wife wasn't quite as understanding, and made that clear. Nonetheless, we married and honeymooned quickly. Then I got back to work.
3. Takedowns. Gun ready. "Wake up! We got a tanker!" I roused myself from the side of the boat where I'd been catching some rest, despite the cold wind and choppy waters. I was soaked from the spray. Despite the fact that I was a new guy on my first deployment, I'd already mastered the art of sleeping in all sorts of conditions, an unheralded but critical SEAL skill. An oil tanker loomed ahead. A helicopter had spotted it trying to sneak down the Gulf after loading up illegally in Iraq. Our job was to get aboard her, inspect her papers, and if, as suspected, she was violating the UN sanctions, turn her over to the Marines or other authorities for processing. I scrambled to get ready. Our RIB, rigid-hulled inflatable boat, used for a variety of SEAL tasks, looked like a cross between a rubber life raft and an open speedboat with two monster motors in the back. 36 feet long, it held 8 SEALs and hit upwards of 45 knots on a calm sea. The exhaust from the twin motors wafted over the boat, mixing with the spray as we gathered speed. We were hauling at a good pace, riding the wake of the tanker where radar couldn't pick us up. I went to work, taking a long pole from the deck of the boat. Our speed dropped as our RIB cut alongside the tanker until we were just about matching its pace. The Iranian ship's engines pulsed in the water, so loud our own motors were drowned out. As we pushed alongside the tanker, I extended the pole upward, trying to angle the grappling hook at the top onto the ship's rail. Once the hook caught, I jerked the pole down. Gotcha. A bungee cord connected the hook to the pole. A steel cable ladder was connected to the hook. Someone grabbed hold of the bottom and held it while the lead man began climbing up the side of the ship. A loaded oil tanker can sit fairly low in the water, so low, in fact, that you sometimes can just grab the rail and hop over. That wasn't the case here. The railing was quite a bit higher than our little boat. I'm not a fan of heights, but as long as I didn't think too much about what I was doing, I was fine. The ladder rocked with the ship and the wind. I pulled myself up as quickly as I could go, my muscles remembering all those pull-ups and buds. By the time I reached the deck, the lead guys were already headed toward the wheelhouse and bridge of the ship. I ran to catch up. Suddenly, the tanker began gaining speed. The captain, belatedly realizing he was being boarded, was trying to head for Iranian waters. If he reached them, we'd have to jump off. Our orders strictly forbade taking any ship outside of international waters. I got up to the head of the team just as they reached the door to the bridge. One of the crew got there at roughly the same time and tried to lock it. He wasn't fast enough or strong enough. One of the boarding party threw himself against the door and bashed it open. I ran through, gun ready. We'd done dozens of these operations over the past few days, and rarely had anyone even hinted of resistance. But the captain of this ship had some fight in him, and even though he was unarmed, he wasn't ready to surrender. He made a run at me. Pretty stupid. First of all, I'm not only bigger than him, but I was wearing full body armor, not to mention the fact that I had a submachine gun in my hand. I took the muzzle of my gun and struck the idiot in his chest. He went right down. Somehow I managed to slip as well. my elbow flew out and landed straight on his face. A couple of times. That pretty much took the fight out of him. I rolled him over and cuffed him. Boarding and searching ships, officially known as VBSS, for Visit Board Search Seas, is a standard SEAL mission. While the regular Navy has specially trained sailors to handle the job in peacetime, we're trained to handle the searches in places where resistance is likely. And in the lead-up to war during the winter of 2002-2003, that meant the Persian Gulf off Iraq. The UN later estimated that in violation of international sanctions, billions of dollars of oil and other items were smuggled out of Iraq and into the pockets of Saddam's regime. Smuggling took on all sorts of forms. You'd find oil being carried in wheat carriers hidden in barrels. More commonly, tankers took on thousands and thousands of gallons in excess of what they were permitted in the UN Oil for Food program. It wasn't just oil. One of the biggest contraband shipments we came across that winter were dates. Apparently, they could fetch a decent price on the world market. It was during those first months of my first deployment that I became acquainted with the Polish Wojskowa Formacja Specjalna Grom im Siszosiemisz Spatoszraniarzy Armii Krajowej, Special Military Formation Grom of the Dark and Silent Parachutists of the Polish Army, better known as Grom. They're the Polish version of the Special Forces with an excellent reputation in special operations, and they worked on the takedowns with us. Generally, we worked off a big ship, which we used as kind of a floating home port for our ribs. Half of the platoon would go out for one 24-hour period. We would sail to a designated spot and drift in the night, waiting. With luck, a helo or a ship would radio intel about a ship coming out of Iraq sailing pretty low in the water. Anything that had a cargo would be boarded and inspected. We'd go out and take it down. A few times we worked with a Mark V boat. The Mark V is a special operations craft that some people have compared to World War II-era PT boats. The craft looks like an armored speedboat, and its job is to get SEALs into harm's way as quickly as possible. Built out of aluminum, it can haul serious ass. The boats are said to hit 65 knots. But what we liked about them were their flat decks behind the superstructure. Ordinarily, we would load two Zodiacs back there. But since the Zodiacs weren't needed, the whole company would board from the ribs and stretch out to grab some sleep until ships were spotted. That beat leaning across the seat or twisting yourself around to rest on the gunwale. Taking down ships in the Gulf quickly became routine. We could take dozens in a night. But our biggest takedown didn't come off Iraq. It was some 1,500 miles away off the coast of Africa. Scuds. In late fall, a SEAL platoon in the Philippines snuck alongside a freighter named the Sosan. From that point on, the North Korean ship was literally a marked vessel. The 3,500-ton freighter had an interesting history of transporting items to and from North Korea. According to one rumor, she had transported chemicals that could be used to create nerve weapons. In this case, though, the Sosan's papers declared that she was carrying cement. What she was really carrying were Scud missiles. The ship was tracked around the Horn of Africa while the Bush administration decided what to do about it. Finally, the president ordered that the ship be boarded and searched, just the sort of job SEALs excel at. We had a platoon in Djibouti, which was a hell of a lot closer to the craft than we were, but because of the way the chain of command and assignments worked, the unit happened to be working from the Marines while we were directly under a Navy command. We were tasked to take down the freighter. You can imagine how happy our sister platoon was to see us when we landed in Djibouti. Not only had we stolen the mission they considered theirs, they had to suffer the indignity of helping us offload and get ready for action. As soon as I got off the plane, I spotted a buddy. "Hey," I shouted. "Fuck off," he answered. "What's up?" "Fuck you." That was the extent of his welcome. I couldn't blame him. In his place, I'd have been pissed myself. He and the others eventually came around. They weren't mad at us. They were mad at the situation. Grudgingly, they helped us prepare for the mission, then got us aboard a mail and resupply helicopter from the USS Nassau, an amphibious assault ship out in the Indian Ocean.
Amphibs, as they were called, are large assault ships that carry troops and helicopters, and occasionally Marine Harrier attack aircraft. They look like old-fashioned aircraft carriers with a straight-through flight deck. They're fairly large and have command and control facilities that can be used as forward planning and command posts during assault operations. There are several ways to take down a ship, depending on the conditions and the target. While we could have used helicopters to get to the So San, looking at photos of the ship, we noticed that there were a number of wires running above the deck. Those wires would have to be removed before we could land, which would add time to the operation. Knowing we'd lose the element of surprise if we went in with helos, we opted to use ribs instead. We started doing practice runs off the side of the Nassau with boats that had been brought out there by a special boat unit. Special boat units are the SEAL's dedicated taxi service. They run the ribs, Mark V's, and other SEAL-related vessels. Among other things, the units are equipped and trained to make combat insertions, braving fire to get SEALs in and out of trouble. The So San, meanwhile, continued sailing toward us. We were geared up as it came within range, preparing to hit it. But before we could board the boats, we got a call telling us to stand by. The Spaniards had moved in. What? The Spanish frigate Navarra had confronted the So San, which had been fooling exactly nobody by sailing without a flag and with her name covered up. According to later reports, Spanish spec op troops went in after the freighter failed to comply with the frigate's orders to stop. Of course, they used helicopters and, just as we had thought, were delayed by having to shoot out the wires. From what I've heard, that delay would have given the captain aboard the vessel time to get rid of incriminating paperwork and other evidence. That's what I think happened. Obviously, there was a lot going on behind the scenes that we weren't aware of. Whatever. Our mission was quickly changed from taking down the ship to going aboard and securing it, and uncovering the Scud missiles. You wouldn't think missiles would be hard to find, but in this case, they were nowhere to be seen. The ship's hold was full of bags of cement, 80-pound bags. There must have been hundreds of thousands. There was only one place the Scuds could be. We started moving cement, bag after bag. That was our job for 24 hours. No sleep, just move bags of cement. I must have moved thousands myself. It was miserable. I was covered with dust. God knows what my lungs looked like. Finally, we found shipping containers underneath. Out came our torches and saws. I worked on one of the quickie saws, also known as a cutoff saw. It looks like a chainsaw with a circular blade on the front. It cuts through just about anything, including Scud containers. 15 Scud missiles lay under the cement. I'd never seen a Scud up close before, and to be honest, I thought they were kind of cool looking. We took pictures, then waved the EOD guys, explosives ordnance disposal or bomb disposal experts, in to make sure they were inert. By that point, the entire platoon was completely covered with cement dust. A few guys went over the side to clean off. Not me. Given my history with dives, I wasn't taking any chances. That much cement? Who the hell knows what happens when it touches the water? We handed the So San over to the Marines and went back aboard the Nassau. Command sent word that we would be pulled out and returned to Kuwait in the same expedient fashion you were brought in. Of course, they were full of shit. We stayed on the Nassau for 2 weeks. For some reason, the Navy couldn't figure out how to free up one of the umpteen helicopters they had sitting on the flight deck to get us back to Djibouti. So we played video games and pumped iron, waiting. That and slept. Unfortunately, the only video game we had with us was Madden Football. I got pretty good at it. Up until that time, I hadn't been much for playing video games. Now I'm an expert, especially at Madden. That was probably where I got hooked. I think my wife still cusses my 2 weeks aboard the Nassau to this very day. A note on the Scuds. The missiles were bound for Yemen, or at least that's what Yemen said. There have been rumors that they were part of some sort of a deal with Libya involving a payoff to take Saddam Hussein into exile, but I have no idea whether that's true or not. In any event, the Scuds were released and went on to Yemen. Saddam stayed in Iraq, and we went back to Kuwait to get ready for war. Christmas. That December was the first Christmas I'd ever been away from my family, and it felt a little depressing. The day kind of came and went without a memorable celebration. I do remember the presents Taya's folks sent that year, though. Remote control Hummers. They were small radio-controlled toys that were just a blast to drive around. Some of the Iraqis working on base had apparently never seen anything like them before. I'd drive a vehicle toward them and they would scream and bolt away. I don't know if they thought it was some sort of guided missile or what. Their high-pitched screams coupled with sprints in the opposite direction had me doubled over. Cheap thrills in Iraq were priceless. Some of the people we had working for us were not exactly the best of the best, nor were all of them particularly fond of Americans. They caught one jerking off into our food. He was quickly escorted from the base. The head shed, our commanding officers, knew that as soon as everyone found out what he'd done, someone would probably try and kill him. We stayed at two different camps in Kuwait, Ali As-Salem and Doha. Our facilities at both were relatively bare bones. Doha was a large U.S. Army base and played important roles in both the first and what would be the second Gulf War. We were given a warehouse there and framed out rooms with the help of some Seabees, the Navy combat engineers. We'd come to rely on the Seabees for similar support in the future. Ali As-Salem was even more primitive, at least for us. There we got a tent and some shelving units. That was about it. I guess the powers that be figured SEALs don't need much. I was in Kuwait when I saw my first desert sandstorm. The day suddenly became night. Sand swirled everywhere. From the distance, you can see a vast orange-brown cloud moving toward you. Then, suddenly, it's black, and you feel like you're in the middle of a swirling mine shaft, or maybe the rinse cycle in a bizarre washing machine that uses sand instead of water. I remember being in an airplane hangar, and even though the doors were closed, the amount of dust in the air was unbelievable. The sand was a fine grit that you never wanted to get in your eyes because it would never come out. We quickly learned to wear goggles to protect them. Sunglasses wouldn't do. 60 Gunner. Being a new guy, I was the 60 Gunner. As I'm sure many of you know, 60 refers to the M60 General Purpose Machine Gun, a belt-fed weapon that has served the U.S. military in a number of versions for several decades. The M60 was developed in the 1950s. It fires 7.62mm bullets. The design is so flexible that it can be used as the basis for a coaxial machine gun in armored vehicles and helicopters, and a light man-carried squad-level weapon. It was a workhorse in the Vietnam War, where grunts called it the pig, and occasionally cursed over the hot barrel, which required an asbestos glove to change after firing a few hundred rounds, not particularly convenient in combat. The Navy made substantial improvements to the weapon over the years, and it remains a potent gun. The newest version is so improved, in fact, that it rates a different designation. The Navy calls it a Mark 43 Mod Zero. Some contend it should be considered a completely separate weapon. I'm not going to wade into that debate. It's comparatively light, in the area of 23 pounds, and has a relatively short barrel. It also has a rail system, which allows scopes and the like to be attached. Also currently in service are M240s, M249s, and the Mark 26, a variant of the M249. As a general rule, the machine guns carried by shooters in my platoons were always called 60s, even when they were actually something else, like the Mark 48. We used more Mark 48s as time went on during my days in Iraq, but unless it's significant for some reason, I refer to any squad-level machine gun as a 60 and leave others to sort out the fine print. The old pig nickname for the 60 survives, which leads a lot of 60 gunners to be called pigs, or a creative variation. In our platoon, a friend of mine named Bob got tagged with it. It never applied to me. My nickname was Tex, which was one of the more socially acceptable things people called me. With war becoming inevitable, we began patrolling the border across Kuwait, making sure that the Iraqis weren't going to try and sneak across in a peremptory strike. We also began training for a role in the upcoming fight. That meant spending quality time in DPVs, also known as sealed dune buggies. DPVs, desert patrol vehicles, look extremely cool from the distance, and they are far better equipped than your average ATV. There's a 50 caliber machine gun and a Mark 19 grenade launcher on the front and an M60 on the back. Then there are the LAW rockets, one-shot anti-tank weapons that are the spiritual descendants of World War II bazookas and Panzerfausts. The rockets are mounted in special brackets on the tubular upper frame. Adding to the coolness factor is the SAT radio antenna on the very top of the vehicle, with a donkey dick radio antenna next to it. Practically every picture you see of a DPV has the sucker flying over a sand dune and popping a wheelie. It is an exceedingly badass image. Unfortunately, it is just that, an image, not a reality. From what I understand, the DPVs were based on a design that had been used in the Baja races. Stripped down, they were undoubtedly mean mothers. The problem is, we didn't drive them stripped down. All that ordnance we carried added considerable weight. Then, there were our rucks, and the water, and the food you need to survive in a desert for a few days. Extra gas, not to mention 3 fully equipped SEALs, driver, navigator, and pig gunner. And in our case, a Texas flag flying off the rear. Both my chief and I were Texans, which made that a mandatory accessory. The load added up quickly. The DPVs used a small Volkswagen engine that was, in my experience, a piece of junk. It was probably fine in a car, or maybe a dune buggy that didn't see combat. But if we took the vehicle out for 2 or 3 days, we'd almost always end up working on it for the same amount of time when we got back. Inevitably, there was some sort of bearing or bushing failing. We had to do our own maintenance. Luckily for us, my platoon included an ASCE-certified mechanic, and he took charge of keeping the vehicles running. But by far their biggest drawback was the fact that they were two-wheel drive. This was a huge problem if the ground was in the least bit soft. As long as we kept going, we were usually okay, but if we stopped, we ended up in trouble. We were constantly digging them out of the sand in Kuwait. They were a blast when they worked. Being the gunner, I had the elevated seat behind the driver and navigator, who sat side by side below me. Geared up with tactical ballistic goggles and a helicopter-type helmet, I strapped myself in with a 5-point restraint and held on as we raced across the desert. We'd do 70 miles an hour. I'd let off a few bursts with the 50 cal, then pull the lever up on the side of the seat and swivel around toward the back. There I'd grab the M60 and shoot some more. If we were simulating an attack from the side while we were moving, I could grab the M4 I was carrying and shoot in that direction. Shooting the big machine gun was fun. Aiming that sucker while the vehicle was bounding up and down across the desert was something else again. You can move the gun up and down to keep it on target, but you're never going to be particularly precise. At best, you lay down enough fire so you can get the hell out of there. Besides our 4 3-seat DPVs, we had 2 6-seaters. The 6-seater was the plain vanilla version, 3 rows of 2 seats with the only weapon, the 60, on the front. We used it as the command and control wagon. Very boring ride. It was kind of like riding in a station wagon with Mom when Dad's got the sports car. We practiced for a few weeks. We did a lot of land navigation, built hide sites, and did SR, surveillance and reconnaissance, along the border. We'd dig in, cover the vehicles with netting, and try to make them disappear in the middle of the desert. Not easy for a DPV. Usually it ended up looking like a DPV trying to hide in the middle of the desert. We also practiced deploying the DPVs out of helicopters, riding out the back when they touched down. A rodeo on wheels. As January neared its end, we started getting worried, not that the war was going to break out, but that it would start without us. The usual SEAL deployment at the time was 6 months. We'd shipped out in September and were due to rotate back to the States within a few weeks. I wanted to fight. I wanted to do what I'd been trained for. American taxpayers had invested considerable dollars in my education as a SEAL. I wanted to defend my country, do my duty, and do my job. I wanted more than anything to experience the thrill of battle. Taya saw things a lot differently. Taya. I was terrified the whole time as the buildup continued toward war. Even though the war hadn't officially started, I knew they were working dangerous ops. When SEALs work, there's always some risk involved. Chris tried to play things down to me so I wouldn't worry, but I wasn't oblivious and I could read between the lines. My anxiety came out in different ways. I was jumpy. I'd see things out of the corner of my eye that weren't there. I couldn't sleep without all the lights on. I'd read every night until my eyes closed involuntarily. I did everything I could to avoid being alone or having too much time to think. Chris called twice with stories about helicopter accidents that he'd been in. Both were extremely minor, but he was worried that they would be reported and that I would hear about them and worry. "I just want you to know, in case you hear it on the news," he'd say, "the Hilo was in a minor bang-up and I'm okay." One day he told me he had to go out on another helicopter exercise. The next morning I was watching the news and they reported that a helicopter had gone down near the border and everyone had died. The newscaster said it had been filled with Special Forces soldiers. In the military, Special Forces refers to Army Special Operations troops, but the newscasters had a tendency to use the term for SEALs. Immediately I jumped to conclusions. I didn't hear from him that day, even though he had promised he'd call. I told myself, "I'm not going to panic. It wasn't him." I poured myself into my work. That night, with still no call, I started to feel a little more anxious, then a little freaked out. I couldn't sleep. I thought I was exhausted from working and holding back the tears that kept threatening to overtake any sense of calm I was faking. Finally, around 1 o'clock, I was starting to crack. The phone rang. I jumped to answer it. "Hey, babe," he said, as cheerful as ever. I started bawling. Chris kept asking what was wrong. I couldn't even choke out the words to explain. My fear and relief came out as unintelligible sobs. After that, I vowed to stop watching the news. 4. 5 minutes to live. Dune buggies and mud don't mix. Geared up and strapped in, I sat vibrating in the gunner's chair of the DPV shortly after nightfall, March 20, 2003, as an Air Force MH-53 lifted off the runway in Kuwait. The vehicle had been loaded into the rear of the Pave-Low aircraft, and we were en route toward the mission we'd spent the past several weeks rehearsing. The waiting was about to come to an end. Operation Iraqi Freedom was underway. My war was finally here. I was sweating, and not just with excitement. Not knowing exactly what Saddam might have in store, we'd been ordered to wear full MOP gear, mission-oriented protective posture, or spacesuits to some. The suits protect against chemical attacks, but they're about as comfortable as rubber pajamas, and the gas mask that comes with them is twice as bad. "Feet wet," said someone over the radio. I checked my guns, and they were ready, including the 50. All I had to do was pull back the charging handle and load. We were pointed straight toward the back of the helicopter. The rear ramp was not all the way up, so I could see out into the night. Suddenly, the black strip I was watching above the ramp speckled with red. The Iraqis had kicked on anti-aircraft radars and weapons that intel had claimed didn't exist, and the chopper pilots began shooting off decoy flares and chaff to confuse them. Then came the tracers, streams of bullets arcing across the narrow rectangle of black. "Damn," I thought, "we're going to get shot down before I even get a chance to smoke someone." Somehow, the Iraqis managed to miss us. The helicopter kept moving, swooping toward land. "Feet dry," said someone over the radio. We were now over land. All hell was breaking loose. We were part of a team tasked to hit Iraqi oil resources before the Iraqis could blow them up or set them on fire as they had during Desert Storm in 1991. SEALs and Grom were hitting gas and oil platforms, GOPLATs, in the Gulf, as well as onshore oil refinery and port areas. 12 of us were tasked to hit farther inland at the Alpha oil refinery area. The few extra minutes it took translated into a hell of a lot of gunfire, and by the time the helicopter touched down, we were in the shit. The ramp dropped and our driver hit the gas. I locked and loaded, ready to fire as we sped down the ramp. The DPV careened into the soft dirt and promptly got stuck. Son of a bitch. The driver started revving the engine and slapping the transmission back and forth, trying to budge us free. At least we were out of the helicopter. One of the other DPVs got stuck half on and half off the ramp. His 53 jerked up and down, trying desperately to free him. Pilots hate like hell to get fired at, and they wanted out. By this time, I could hear the different DPV units checking in over the radio. Just about everybody was stuck in the oil-soaked mud. The intel specialist advising us had claimed that the ground would be hard-packed where we were going to land. Of course, she and her colleagues had also claimed that the Iraqis didn't have anti-aircraft weapons. Like they say, military intelligence is an oxymoron. "We're stuck," said our chief. "Yeah, we're stuck too," said the lieutenant. "We're stuck," said somebody else. "Buck, we gotta get out of here." "All right, everybody get out of your vehicles and go to your positions," said the chief. I undid the 5-point harness, grabbed the 60 off the back, and humped in the direction of the fence that blocked off the oil facility. Our job was to secure the gate, and just because we didn't have wheels to do it didn't mean it wasn't getting done. I found a pile of rubble inside of the gate and set up the 60. A guy came up next to me with a Carl Gustav, technically a recoilless rifle. The weapon fires a badass rocket that can take out a tank or poke a hole in a building. Nothing was getting through that gate without our say-so. The Iraqis had set up a defensive perimeter outside the refinery. Their only problem was that we had landed inside. We were now between them and the refinery. In other words, behind their positions. They didn't like that all that much. They turned around and started firing at us. As soon as I realized that we weren't getting gassed, I threw off my gas mask. Returning fire with the 60, I had plenty of targets. Too many, in fact. We were heavily outnumbered. But that was not a real problem. We began calling in air support. Within minutes, all sorts of aircraft were overhead. FA-18s, F-16s, A-10As, even an AC-130 gunship. The Air Force A-10s, better known as Warthogs, were awesome. They're slow-moving jets, but that's intentional. They're designed to fly low and slow so they can put a maximum amount of gunfire on ground targets. Besides bombs and missiles, they're equipped with a 30mm Gatling cannon. Those Gatlings chewed the hell out of the enemy that night. The Iraqis rolled armor out of the city to get us, but they never got close. It got to the point where the Iraqis realized they were fucked and tried to flee. Big mistake. That just made them easier to see. The planes kept coming, nailing them. They had them zeroed in and zeroed them out. You'd hear the rounds coming past you in the air. Then you'd hear the echo, followed closely by secondary explosions and whatever other havoc the bullets caused. Fuck, I thought to myself, this is great. I fucking love this. It's nerve-wracking and exciting, and I fucking love it. Gassed. A British unit flew in the morning. By then the battle was over. Of course, we couldn't resist needling them about it. "Come on in, the fight's over," we said. "It's safe for you." I don't think they thought it was funny, but it was hard to tell. They speak English funny. Exhausted, we moved back inside the gate to a house that had been almost completely destroyed during the firefight. We went into the ruins, dropped down between the rubble, and fell asleep. A few hours later, I got up. Most of the other guys in my company were stirring as well. We went outside and started checking the perimeter of the oil fields. While we were out, we spotted some of the air defenses the Iraqis didn't have. But the intel reports didn't have to be updated. Those defenses were now in no shape to bother anyone. There were dead bodies everywhere. We saw one guy who'd literally had his ass blown off. He'd bled to death, but not before he tried to drag himself away from the planes. You could see the blood trail in the dirt. While we were sorting things out, I spotted a Toyota pickup in the distance. It drove up on the road and stopped a little more than a mile away. White civilian pickup trucks were used by the Iraqis as military vehicles throughout the war. Usually, they were some version of the Toyota Hilux, the compact pickup built in a variety of styles. In the States, the Hilux was often called the SR-5. The model was eventually discontinued here, though it continued to be sold overseas. Not sure what was going on, we stared at the truck for a few moments until we heard a whoop. something went splat a few yards from us. The Iraqis had fired a mortar round from the rear bed. It sank harmlessly into the oily mud. "Thank God that thing didn't blow up," somebody said. "We'd be dead." White smoke started pouring out of the hole where the projectile had landed. "Gas!" yelled someone. We started running as fast as we could back to the gate, but just before we reached it, the British guards slammed it shut and refused to open it. "You can't come in," one of them yelled. "You've just been gassed." While Marine Cobras flew in overhead to take care of the mortar trucks, we tried to figure out if we were going to die. When we were still breathing a few minutes later, we realized the smoke had been just that. Smoke. Maybe it was steam from the mud. Whatever. It was all sizzle, no boom, no gas. Which was a relief. Shat al-Arab. With Al-Faw secured, we rigged up two of our DPVs and hit the road, driving north to Shat al-Arab, the river that separates Iran and Iraq as it flows out to the Gulf. Our job was to look for suicide boats and mine layers that might be coming down the river to the Gulf. We found an old border station abandoned by the Iraqis and set up an observation post. Our ROEs, when the war kicked off, were pretty simple. If you see anyone from about 16 to 65 and they're male, shoot them. Kill every male you see. That wasn't the official language, but that was the idea. Not that we were watching Iran, however. We were under strict orders not to fire, at least not at Iran. Every night, someone on the other side of the river would stand up and take a shot at us. We would dutifully call it in and ask for permission to return fire. The answer was always a very distinct no, very loud and clear. Looking back, this made a lot of sense. Our heaviest weapons were a Carl Gustav and 260s. The Iranians had plenty of artillery, and they had the position dialed in. It wouldn't have taken anything for them to hit us, and in fact, what they were probably trying to do was suck us into a fight so they could kill us. It did piss us off, though. Somebody shoots at you. You want to shoot back. After the high of the start of the war, our spirits sagged. We were just sitting around doing nothing. One of the guys had a video camera, and we made a video poking fun at it. There wasn't much else to do. We found a few Iraqi weapons and gathered them in a pile to be blown up, but that was it. The Iraqis weren't sending boats our way, and the Iranians would only fire a single shot, then duck and wait for us to react. About the most entertaining thing we could do was wade into the water and piss in their direction. For a week, we took turns on watch. Two guys on, four guys off. Monitored the radio and watched the water. Finally, we were relieved by another set of SEALs and headed back to Kuwait. The race to Baghdad. By now, the so-called race to Baghdad had begun. American and Allied units were streaming across the border, making large advances every day. We spent a few days hanging around our camp back in Kuwait, waiting for an assignment. As frustrating as our stay at the border station was, this was worse. We wanted to be in action. There were any number of missions we could have accomplished, eliminating some of those non-existent air defenses farther into Iraq, for example, but the command didn't seem to want to use us. Our deployment had been extended so that we could take part in the beginning of the war, but now the rumor was that we would be rotated back to the States and replaced by Team 5. No one wanted to leave Iraq now that the action was getting hot. Morale hit rock bottom. We were all pissed off. To top things off, the Iraqis had sent some Scuds over just before the war started. Most had been taken care of by Patriot missiles, but